Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für die Dame, die mehr als einverstanden ist, wenn ihr Anruf bei der Kundenhotline zu Schulungszwecken aufgezeichnet wird. Heute mit einer neuen Episode aus New York, mit einem neuen Gespräch aus New York. Dort scheint es ja gerade auch für Stars sehr interessant zu sein, am Off-Broadway zu spielen. Emma und Bailey deuteten das ja im letzten Gespräch auch schon an. Lange Zeit war das eigentlich gar nicht so üblich. Inzwischen passiert es immer häufiger, dass auch Celebrity-Stars, Schauspielstars, Hollywood-Stars sagen, sucht mir ein Projekt, sucht mir ein Stück am Off-Broadway. Und nicht erst seit Hamilton passiert es ja auch, dass kleinere Produktionen, Off-Broadway-Produktionen, wenn sie dort erfolgreich laufen, von einem kleineren Haus auf Broadway eben an den Broadway wechseln. Die Blaupause dafür, A Chorus Line, das 1975, Mitte der 70er Jahre am Public Theater entsteht und dann ein wahnsinniger Kassenschlager wird und an den Broadway wechselt. Genauso wie das mit Hamilton passiert ist. Was tatsächlich, fällt mir gerade auf, auch so ein Stück ist, wo Lin-Manuel Miranda, ich habe ja in einer der letzten Folgen darüber gesprochen, dass es immer so Persönlichkeiten gibt, die so Stücke um sich herum stricken. Da ist natürlich Hamilton auch so ein Beispiel dafür, dass Texter, Komponist Lin-Manuel Miranda sich diese Hamilton-Figur auf den Leib schreibt und natürlich auch erstmal nicht die Nase gerümpft wird, wenn er sagt, dieses Projekt zirkelt sozusagen auf eine Art auch um mich herum als Hauptdarsteller, Macher und Komponist. Also, viele Off-Broadway-Häuser haben auch inzwischen Musicals im Programm, eben in der Hoffnung, dass diese an den Broadway wechseln, weil das bedeutet natürlich auch nochmal viel größere Einnahmen, ganz andere Dimensionen. Eine Legende auf diesem Gebiet ist James Nicola, der 24 Jahre lang Artistic Director, künstlerischer Leiter des New York Theater Workshops war. Er hat dort wahnsinnig viel für den AutorInnen-Nachwuchs getan und mit den wichtigsten AutorInnen der zeitgenössischen Dramatik zusammengearbeitet und ihre Stücke präsentiert. Jeremy O'Harris, Enda Walsh, Carol Churchill, Tony Kushner, sehr viele Zusammenarbeiten mit Ivo van Hove. Aber er hat eben immer wieder auch Musicals produziert. Und was ich ganz interessant finde im Gespräch, er nennt beides Plays. Also wenn er über Musicals spricht, nennt er sie Plays. Wenn er über Plays spricht, nennt er sie natürlich auch Plays. Unter den Musicals, die am New York Theater Workshop entstanden sind, unter seiner Leitung, sind Titel wie Lazarus, Once, Hadestown und Rent. Wenn man diese Titel hört, wird man sich denken können, welche Bedeutung James Nicola für die amerikanische Theaterlandschaft hat. 2022 wurde er dann auch mit einem Special Tony Award ausgezeichnet. Es war mir eine Riesenehre, ihn treffen zu dürfen und ich finde, es ist ein wahnsinnig interessantes Gespräch. Es geht nicht nur um sein Leben, sondern immer auch um allgemeine Betrachtungen zur Kunst- und Theaterproduktion in Amerika. Nebenbei erzählt er noch eine kurze Geschichte des Non-For-Profit-Theaters in Amerika. Und wir sprechen natürlich auch über legendäre Momente wie Rent oder Slave Play. Viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit James Jim Nicola.
You nodded so heavily when I said like the separation of arts and entertainment we have in Germany. What are your thoughts on this or what came to mind?
Well, one of the things that really strikes me, particularly for Germany, but anywhere in European culture, I spent a lot of time in Amsterdam. I lived for 2 years in London. I have my family roots are in Northern Italy, in Turin. So I've been all over there.
You probably saw some theater in Berlin.
Yes. I've been twice to the Theater Treffen. Which, you know, was amazing. And I always feel that I come from a very adolescent culture. You know, a 14-year-old. And it's very emotional and very unstructured and finding its way. And there's many wonderful things about that. But when you're in a place like over there, you see, oh, well, this is a mature, thoughtful, intentional, not, again, good things and bad things, but it's more chosen than this is sort of like, ugh, throw it all up.
You think like America is this
adolescent? Yes. Very much so.
Because it's so young.
Yes. And it was founded on such radical ideas that are still very much being tested and challenged and worked through, lived, as opposed to just conceptually.
Yeah.
In Germany, particularly, history is very present. Mm-hmm. In America, we don't even think about it. We don't even know that it exists. And I'm a person who is very much from childhood, from my first memories are, how did it get to be the way that it is? Like, why is that wall there? And that. So, and it has only grown with my life as it's unfolded. That certainly has carved out a place for me in this culture because I'm different than most in more ways than that. Mm-hmm. But to back to the, your conversation and what's going on, I think there's a foundational unconscious level in human beings in any community that's forged, be that a nation, a city, whatever. And there are things underneath the consciousness that are values and important ideas that play out and dominate behavior and choices made. And one has to be very rigorous with oneself about tracking where does that need to do that come from. And we don't think too much about that. However, what's beneath all of this for Americans, I believe, is the sort of religious Puritanism that founded this earliest part of European occupation in this part of the world, at least forged this country. The religious wackos that got kicked out of England because they were too nutty came here and started it all. And we have that within us. And the biggest thing that I contend with on that is that it shapes the mind to expect life as it unfolds to be good or evil. You're either with Jesus or you're with Satan. And if you're not with Jesus, you're with Satan.
That's it.
Yep.
Okay. But what kind of theater does this?
Well, it doesn't allow theater, first of all, for 200 of the 300 years that we've been existing, because that was not in church. It was satanic. So only to like mid-19th century, which was, you know, well into it, did we start to think about maybe we like being with Satan.
So and theater maybe, is Satan.
Yes. Unless you make money. Or gain fame, or both, even better. Then that's with Jesus.
Oh, that's interesting, because in Germany, I would have said, like, the money is definitely Satan's side.
Yes, yes. That's what's so wonderful for me to go and be in a different place. That's more attuned to what I believe.
Yeah.
Well, or I try to escape that sort of binary, you know, because as much as it would be convenient for life to be that clear as it unfolds.
Yeah.
In my experience, never is, ever.
Yeah.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
It's always a question of finding a balance and finding the defining element of a life, as far as I've now understood at 74, is the integrity with which you form this compromise. That you know why you're doing it and you're comfortable with the complex things within that choice, but it's not this or it's not that. It's something forged that you'd create, that one creates. But also, theater and art occupy a very different place in the German mind, and soul and cultural identity, and that you come to sit in a theater seat to figure out what you think. And here, you go and sit in a theater seat to be distracted from Jesus.
To feel.
To feel. To love spectacle. To see, you know, in the 19th century, a woman lift her leg, her skirt, so you could see her ankle. This transgressive element was really powerful. It was maybe a place you were a little bit ashamed to go to. And you didn't want to necessarily be seen. Whereas I felt in Germany, we're here because we love being here. We're here to congregate. So it felt
we don't give you only the ankle.
Right.
We give you.
Yes. Yes.
We're exactly. Completely naked.
Yes. But and fine.
Yes.
Fine.
Yeah.
And so I still feel in some ways I'm much more suited to that culture than this one. But this then gives me sort of a missionary place to be here.
I'm always interested in these interviews also, like, to go to the beginning. Like, how did you came in contact with theater at all here in America? How does it work? Because I know how it works in Germany. So people are, you play the violin, maybe people, the parents take you to the theater once a week. How does it work? Did it work for you?
I was born in 1950. So post-war and a sort of euphoric atmosphere, a triumphalist atmosphere, like we're the best, we're, we don't do whatever. I grew up in the suburbs, very white, very Eisenhower America, I keep calling it. But right from the get-go, there was something to, in me that was not going to fit. And that, of course, I didn't understand until much later was that I was gay. I went for a good 10 years thinking I'm not going to have a life. There's no way for me to fit into what is expected of me. And then my parents, you know, were trying to butch me up and wanted me to play Little League baseball and not for me. I just didn't get it. But then in the local newspaper, I was 10. I saw that the local amateur theater was going to start a thing for children. And it electrified me. And I knew this is where I was going to be.
Interesting. But how did you know about theater? If your parents maybe didn't go or...
I just knew. We knew about musicals.
Yeah, of course.
And I also, at that point, was unclear if it was theater for me or music. As I was a singer. And I think that probably emerged even sooner for me because in school we were learning and that was the area that I could be better than everybody else, where people would yield to me. Whereas usually I was object of scorn as a little sissy and not a boy like they understood boys were supposed to be. It was very clear to me that's where I was headed. It was some sort of theater, music, I didn't really know. I mean, I knew that I saw actors on TV or in movies, a little bit on stage. I know that for my 10th birthday, my mother took me to see a musical in summer stock. So it was very cheesy, but nonetheless, it was professionals.
Yeah. So your parents went to the theater?
My mother did. My father is Italian and Italian immigrant and an engineer, but as I've discovered, a much more open-minded kind of person just by nature. My mother was more, she was the one that liked shows and, you know, looking back when I was probably 3-4 years old, and this is not something I remember, it's legend and myth told to me that when I was asked what I wanted to be when I grew up, I said I wanted to be a minister because I was raised in the Baptist church, but not the sort of conservative, you know, kind of nutjob church. It was New England version. So it was very Quaker-ish and much more focused on studying the life of Jesus. Not so much the life of Jesus, but the ideas that he put forward as a model of ethical life. And so less about the woo-woo stuff, but more about how do you live a moral life?
Yeah.
So the church was anti-war, anti-Vietnam War, pro-civil rights, which was a big struggle in the 60s when I was an adolescent. And there was something about the gathering of people to be together, to learn and to grow and be better. That was really, when I look back as an artistic director of a theater, I think that's ultimately what I did. But it was just in a secular frame, not a religious frame. So in college, that's the moment where in this culture, people make big decisions or you're 17. So you're finally sort of somewhat of a person and can start to make some decisions or start to claim your decisions for yourself. You're going to define your own life. So for where I was, choosing which college to go to was the big shaping decision. I was not sure it was music, theater, whatever. But I went, got accepted to 4 different universities. 3 of the 4 were conservatory training for music. Some had some theater in mixed in there, but largely music. But then this one that I kind of was the emotional favorite that I did get into was a liberal arts college. So you didn't go down the road of professional training. You were learning and expanding your information. And something about that at 17 seemed important for me. Like, I felt like I don't know anything about history, philosophy, political science, economy, nothing. I know nothing of that. And when I looked at the syllabus for those other programs, at the beginning, there was one semester of English and one semester of a foreign language, and the rest of it was music. Mm-hmm. And that just felt, that can come later for me. I really need to know more. And this university I went to, which is Tufts University outside of Boston, had a massive commitment to the third year of the four of sending you off into the world somewhere to study for a whole year. And I really liked that. And their theater program had a London program that was really great. So that's where I went my third year. And then I stayed another 6 months past the program, even though I was supposed to go back and finish because I was working in the British theater.
What did you do there?
I worked at the Royal Court Theater in London and the Young Vic. And I was like assistant stage manager and assistant director. And then I got kicked out because I didn't have papers.
Okay.
And I went back and finished semester at Tufts and then came to New York, where I always knew I was going to end up because this is the theater place in the country. And it's also at the time, the gay center. And I didn't know how to be anything but that. Yeah. So anyway, in college, I think I understood. I understood very clearly. I am not a performer. I thought the question was, are you a singer? Are you an actor? And then there was a playwriting course, and it was taught in the senior last year. So this young man had written a short play, and so I was in one of those. This was written by a young man who had been in the London program, and he wrote his little play about going to visit a prostitute in London. So I'm playing him, and it's two people, and my best friend, Margie, is playing the prostitute. And we're standing on stage in our underwear, which was not fun for me to begin with. But this is like 1969. You know, in gay study here, we all have a marker of the Stonewall riots of 1969, which was June of 69. So this was 3 or 4 months after that. And as it turned out, most of the men around me who were drama majors turned out in the end to be gay, but no one was discussing it. It was not open. It was not allowed. We talked about it. We joked about it, but no one owned it. I was doing a double life. I was going into Boston to the gay bars and hanging out and then coming back and being not straight, but not gay, just nothing. So this moment, I'm on the stage in my underwear, pretending to want to fuck my best friend, Margie. There's no way that's going to happen ever, even in real life. No way, no way. But I'm pretending to be straight and I'm frozen and I couldn't remember my next line. And somewhere in that moment, this is the glory to me of a liberal education, is it makes room for this kind of thing to happen. I had these light bulbs go off, like probably if you want to be any kind of performer, singer, actor, whatever it is, you have to not only tolerate standing in front of everyone almost naked. You actually have to like that and need that. Mm-hmm. And I know that people can change and go to therapy, but that's never going to change in me. That is a foundational thing. It's never going to change. I'm never going to be comfortable on this. So maybe I need to do something else. And luckily, again, the beautiful part about a liberal arts program is within 2 months, I directed my first play. So very early on, that was the focus for me. And I'm forever grateful for that moment of awareness.
Oh, yes.
Because there are so many people who don't have that luxury. The other thing that on that subject that happened to me in the spring of 1968 in New York City, the play Boys in the Band opened.
Yeah.
And it was a big shock. I went to Boston. The Boston company of Boys in the Band had just opened. Oh. And I couldn't get there fast enough because I knew this was going to be for me, about me and life. So yeah.
What did you learn from that experience?
I was 18. What I learned was, thought it was just about who you wanted to fuck. But actually what this play is showing to me is it's actually a community that has rituals, that has language, that has a bond. And that just electrified me. There were things in it that I didn't understand. I heard a line that still sticks in my mind, which was sarcastic. You look like you've been rimming a snowman. And I didn't know what rimming was. I thought, why is everybody around me laughing at that? But I don't get it. Oh. Or if they were laughing, made jokes about Betty Davis. You know, can't be Betty Davis things. Yeah. And to me, Betty Davis is some old movie star that my mother likes. But what opened to me through a play, seeing a play, by being an audience member in a theater, that my life was possible, that I had a community. There was so exciting to become a part of that. Mm-hmm. And I could see the good and the bad of that, but it was something. It was an anchor. It was a defining place. Yeah. Anyway.
So you worked as a director then?
For a little bit.
Okay.
I graduated in 72. I came to New York. I learned from some amazingly inspiring two particular people. Mm-hmm. One was a guy named Joseph Papp, and one was a woman named Zelda Fitchandler. And Joe was the founder of the New York Shakespeare Festival, and I worked there from age 25 to 30. And then I worked with Zelda at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., which was one of the very first and most prominent regional theaters. So I spent 80 to 88 with her, and then in 88, I came to New York Theatre Workshop.
What did you do for them? You were a director. You directed
pieces. When I was at the Public Theater, yeah. Shakespeare Festival, yeah. 1975 to 1980, I was working at the casting office. So which was a wonderful perch in the process of mm-hmm. watching a director and a playwright negotiate with each other. And the conversations that happened after an actor read a scene were really important and foundational and big important decisions were made. So it was a very good place to meet. And the Shakespeare Festival at that time was the apex of American theater. It was the Public Theater, which had 7 or 8 spaces in it. And I was there, started in 75. I think he moved in there in 67. He had the Free Shakespeare in the Park. The New York Shakespeare Festival was the constituent in theater at Lincoln Center. So the Beaumont, the Newhouse were there for the New York Shakespeare Festival for Joe. And he was renting Broadway theaters and doing new plays on Broadway. So we were kind of everywhere in many different formats. And there was also this incredible downtown focused in the East Village off Broadway. La Mama, The Remnants of Joe, Cafe Chino. And I was directing like crazy there.
Also, like working there, yep. Earning your money there, yep. But probably the directing stuff didn't.
Correct.
You didn't earn any money with it?
No one expected it. To make money. It was because we loved it and we believed in it and we were changing the world.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, 4th Street, where the New York Theatre Workshop was kind of ground zero of it, mm-hmm. Between 2nd Avenue and Bowery. And right on that corner of Bowery and 4th Street is a restaurant bar called Phoebe's, mm-hmm. which was the gathering place for all of the denizens of off Broadway. So I spent many a night there. Amongst very interesting people.
I guess so, yes.
Yeah.
Can you maybe talk a little bit about the history of the non-for-profit theater in America? Because the Public Theater, also the New York Theater Workshop, where you ended up being artistic director for over 20 years, were non-for-profit theaters.
And the whole notion of a not-for-profit theater, of an art theater, took shape in the 60s. We're talking about this moment of post-war. The 50s were people like my mother and father, whose lives had been shaped and disrupted and transformed by first a Great Depression and then a massive world war. And my father fought in World War II in Germany, actually, Belgium and Germany. He first was in Italy because he spoke Italian, and I think he was useful to the military then. But the 50s was kind of the moment of we're we're at peace, we can live our lives, we're done with the depression, we're starting to have a little money, the war is over, all is good, we won. There was this shadowing thing of burgeoning communism that was not quite as potent, but was looming. But the 60s was the extension of that confidence to say, we can build a society that we have the means to make it whatever we want it to be. And there was a certain male patriarchal class, old wealth. When I go to Lincoln Center and I'm walking on that plaza where the big fountain is, yeah, and I'm standing between the orchestra, the opera, and the ballet, and I'm thinking, these are organizations that were forged in the Gilded Age, in the 1890s, with wealth that was accumulated. And the people that founded these things wrote one check for this to exist. And they had that kind of wealth. And they also had the imperative, self-imperative, to contribute, to, mm-hmm, to make the world a better place. So they built an opera house. They built an orchestra. And the 60s was a moment of like, well, where do we go with that now? It's a new world. And particularly a guy named Mac Lowry, who was at the Ford Foundation, which is, you know, Ford automobile fortune. Tyrone Guthrie arrived from London. Do you know Tyrone? No. Sir Tyrone Guthrie was in that community of Laurence Olivier, very fancy British actors at the Old Vic School and Theatre. And he came here and he started the Shakespeare Festival in Canada, mm-hmm, that's still huge. And then he moved from there to Minneapolis and started the Guthrie Theatre. And that was basically the blueprint that was handed to the Ford Foundation. And it was based on the idea that a resident acting company performing in repertory all the classical canon, Shakespeare, Goethe, Chekhov, all of that. And that you would see these actors from night to night jump from this, yeah, this to this, this.
It's the system we have in.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So that's what was installed. And that Ford Foundation gave money to start in all many, many, many American cities to seed a theater like that. And then gave money to support them financially for the first 4 or 5 years. And the notion that these patriarchs came up with is that there would be something created called the National Endowment for the Arts that would be a very European style funder, take over the role of the foundation. So the foundation was really a transformational impulse. Mm-hmm. And then we were supposed to incorporate that into our being. That part never happened in any significant way. It wasn't about making money. It was about needing money and being a siphon of money. That we already had the notion of not-for-profit with schools, hospitals, mm-hmm, libraries, museums, but theaters, well, theaters are Broadway. They make money. It's like film, television. Who would ever think those would be not-for-profit? Their purpose is to, you know, tap into the things that people are interested in seeing and making money on. So this was Guthrie, and that crowd said, no, we're actually here to make you hear Shakespeare. So, you know, you read Shakespeare maybe if you were lucky in a school, in high school, but it was on the shelf. It was a book and you read it. We're saying Shakespeare needs to be, it only is actually authentic if it's performed in the mouth of an actor. You hear it, not read it. Mm-hmm. And we were very fluent in the commerce part because we had film and television. Mm-hmm. And that was, there was amazing stuff going on there, but it was always at the root about making money. And it's not about making money. It's about losing money and accepting that as a good value, mm-hmm, in this culture, this puritanical culture, where you're losing money, you're with Satan.
Well, that's subversive, though.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Abso-fucking-lutely. The other big selling point, there are going to be professional artists living here amongst us. If we do King Lear, people from New York are going to have to come to Hartford to see our King Lear. They're not going to get to see it if they don't come to Hartford.
We'll not see it on Broadway.
Right, right. So it was this moment of civic pride. And I think these regional theaters were a part of building a landscape of communities.
So that was probably also the time when the Off-Broadway theater was non-for-profit.
Yes, that led to the Off-Broadway world becoming pretty much exclusively over a couple of decades, not-for-profit theaters like New York Theatre Workshop, The Atlantic, the New York Shakespeare Festival, La Mama, all of us. We pretty much extinguished the commercial Off-Broadway world. But what's happening right now is those not-for-profits are dying. They're in real trouble. And the commercial Off-Broadway world is back. It's like Little Shop of Horrors is running Off-Broadway for years now. And my theory about that is that you can open a show like Little Shop of Horrors for probably $1 million budget. But if you did that on Broadway, it would be 10. And if it doesn't go well, you've lost $10 million. If you've done it Off-Broadway and you do it well, and you can always move it to Broadway.
Chorus Line also happened while you were at the Public, no?
What happened?
Yeah.
When I was at the Public in 1975, I started. At the time, there was a staff of about, 100 people. And I was a lowly assistant in the casting office. And within a couple of days of my being there, this young gay man who worked across the street in a costume shop, so not really like the very different end of production process than what I was doing, came and sat at my desk and chatted with me. And it was like a little odd. And what I now understood is that there was, as there often was in those days, in a staff of 100, particularly in a theater, there were probably at least a third of those were gay men. And there was a network of communication amongst the gay guys that was in some ways very helpful, because you could tell one and then everyone knew, all the staff knew, but you didn't have to make it official. You're just like, those queens stopped. Yeah. So I was being interviewed to see if I was a worthy, or was I going to be a part of this or not, whatever. Part of that discussion was, said to me, oh yeah, upstairs right now, there's a workshop going on. The director, Michael Bennett, choreographer, Michael Bennett, got a bunch of chorus boys drunk one night and he taped them. And then he transcribed their confessionals. And now he thinks he's going to make a musical out of it. And then 3 months later, a Chorus Line opened and was a huge hit. And what that did is open the door for the not-for-profit theater to accept this largely authentic American art form, mm-hmm. musical theater, to be a part of their world. Up until a Chorus Line, musicals, absolutely not.
Interesting, I have no idea.
Yeah. So it changed everything. Not the least of which was how the financial benefit of producing that play and then moving it to Broadway was to that organization. Mm-hmm. The money coming in was, we didn't have to do fundraisers and we didn't have to have cocktail parties with rich people. These were just checks coming in the mail. It changed the world. And now you are seeing essentially not-for-profit theaters exist because commercial producers make an investment, subsidize a new musical at a not-for-profit, and then they move it to Broadway, and then the not-for-profit gets a little percentage, which we did with Rent, pretty much.
Yes.
Kind of pretty much solidified that.
So Chorus Line molded that kind of model of,
yes,
do something the whole city talks about in this, yep, non-for-profit theater and take it to...
Right.
But did this also put like some kind of pressure on the non-for-profit,
sure,
theaters to... Every 2 years, yes, we need some kind of,
yep,
hit.
Yep, absolutely. In a very bad way, very negative and uncreative way, I think.
When you started as artistic director at Newark Theatre Workshop, was it always a place for musicals?
No. The workshop, you know who a woman named Catherine Graham is? She, in the 70s, was a very significant cultural figure in that she was a woman who was the owner and publisher of the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
And she came to prominence, to public.
Is it the lady from the movie?
Like, yes.
Yeah. Meryl Streep.
Yes. Basically. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
She said no to Richard Nixon and all of that.
Yeah.
So her son, Stephen, was the founder of New York Theatre Workshop. he started it in 1979, and he was commercially focused producer. So he was doing things like new Sam Shepard play off Broadway. He did a new play from Athol Fugard, the South African, The Road to Mecca, off Broadway. But he was 28-ish, 29-ish, and he was realizing that the things that, because his heritage was very educated, literary kind of taste, good taste, intelligence. The things that were exciting to him personally that he felt compelled to make room for were probably not very good commercial prospects. They were too intellectual, too artistic, whatever, whatever. So he founded a, he made a foundation with a couple of friends, which was to support artists, makers. And the big thing that he did in 79, and this is what really ultimately was the thing that drew me to this theater, is it was not just about supporting the playwright. It was also equally important to support the director. So in 1979 in America, we had things like new dramatists. We had the O'Neill Center, which was all for new writing and supporting new playwrights. Every regional theater, not-for-profit theater, had pretty much developed some sort of like week-long new play project kind of thing. So there was not enough and not good enough, and you know, but at least it was pretty present, the concept of supporting the writer. But no one was doing anything on behalf of the director. And that, as a young director, was very irritating to me. So they started by taking people on. They took people on. The first director they took on, or at the very start, was a director named Peter Sellers, right out of Harvard. That was 79 to about 83. They hired a wonderful woman to be the administrator of the foundation, and she pretty much persuaded them to sort of come out of the closet and become a theater. And she and they invented the name New York Theater Workshop, which embodied for them the dual function of being a theater, a place for an audience to come and congregate and learn and grow and be provoked and whatever, and also a workshop, a place to support the artists and their process and their way of being. And they were tied together in the frame of New York. And I, that's what really sold me. To this day, when you look at criticism, they always pay attention to the playwright and then the directors, directed by whatever. Yeah. Unless, this was a big clue to me, when you go to see a new production of Aida at the Met, you're not writing about the opera. You are sort of, but mostly you're writing about the interpretation of, and how that story is being told by that director.
That's right, yeah.
So that was the thinking, is that if we want to stay focused on the director, we have to do not new plays. And that was incredibly opening up. One of the directors, for example, did a 1,000-year-old Japanese play by Chikamatsu. It had never, as far as I know, been seen in New York or in, maybe even in this country.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah.
So we were getting that kind of thing. And that, that when you stepped back and you looked at the body of work of this theater, you saw, oh, they're doing Chikamatsu and they're doing a new Sam Shepard. And it's all mixed together. And the important thing is they're in the context of each other. You know, the Chikamatsu is making you look differently at Sam Shepard, and Sam Shepard is making you look differently at Chikamatsu. You may never looked at it before, but you're seeing him now like this. This is really healthy and good.
They had always amazes me is really like that Japanese play never done thousands of years, that the same venue also produces a musical.
Yes.
This would be unthinkable in Germany.
Yeah.
How did
it was here too.
Okay, it was here too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it was a serious off-Broadway art theater.
Yeah.
So they worked with writers and directors. None of that commercial theater stuff.
Even though Chorus Line, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, but still.
No.
Yeah, this would be early 80s. So yeah. they were still learning that lesson. That was still not quite conscious what the transformational aspect of Chorus Line was. It's beginning to, but not yet. The first musical that we did, and I did it very consciously, was an adaptation of Virginia Woolf's novel, The Waves. Mm-hmm. And a young composer, lyricist, and a young director that I was very interested in and believed in wanted to do this project. So I said, well, that's what we're going to do. New director's project had a very rigorous structure to it. So each director got 2 weeks of rehearsal and a 2-week run and a limited budget. I remember we did Goethe's Stella in that season as well. No one had done Stella. And you know who did the, Tony Kushner did the translation adaptation. So it was very structured and it limited things because there was a certain amount of budget and not only money, but time. It, over time, I got to realize that what we were doing, because we were also inviting the press to come and review these projects, which I thought was ultimately important to give the director, the role of the director, that kind of focus. But plays, we were giving them a much bigger budget, 4 weeks of rehearsal, some previews, then open. These poor directors were getting 2 weeks of rehearsal, a tiny budget, and on the second or third show, the New York Times was there forming an opinion. And almost always it was not good. And it was devastating to those young directors. And it was occurring to me that we needed to break this up. We needed to change this. This was a good idea, but this form of it wasn't working right. So The Waves was how we smashed that because they had a huge budget, maybe the biggest we'd ever had for anything. It was still a new director's project. So right there, we were defying the rules. And we did it. And it was beautiful, beautiful. But that would be 1990. We left that smaller theater. We were on Perry Street in 92. And that's when Jonathan saw us renovating our space and dropped off this incipient version of Rent.
So you were changing in a new theater, were renovating a space, and Jonathan Larson came by on his bike to drop off a cassette with his demos for the musical Rent. That's what happened.
Yes. He had this idea of a show to do in the East Village. We were in the East Village.
It seemed somehow like approachable to get into and give a cassette to.
So that process of figuring out from 92 to 96 when we ultimately did it was the organization learning to do that process as well.
What happened in those 6 years?
It's one thing for me to read a script and have an opinion about it and make a decision about yes or no or whatever, but that's not what a play is. A play is in the mouth of actors. So if I was interested, what I read in a play and the page, we would then do a reading where we would actually rehearse a little bit, bring in a director, talk about it. Oh, when that actor said that, yeah, well, that's not really how I meant that line. So I got so much more information about the aspiration of the writer, which was often not on the page yet. I got a sense of I'm the right collaborator because maybe often I'm not the right collaborator. That project deserves someone who understands what they're after in a way that I don't. So we want to do a reading. And just on the most elemental levels, like, oh, so we not only have to Xerox a script, we also have to Xerox a score. Oh, we need a rehearsal room with a piano.
We need a piano.
These were things that were not a part of our way. And we were learning and growing. And that was, it became conscious for me somewhere in the middle of that, that, oh, this is good. This is a good kind of growth. Not growth just become big, but growth because we want to be better and more diverse. I don't think I'd ever lost my taste for musical theater, even though with Joe, I was in a Shakespeare theater and I was in a political theater and a social justice kind of theater. That was always there, always there. And I knew it would come back in some way. And Rent was the sort of, oh, I think this means something to me. So I'm maybe a worthy collaborator. In
this was on this tape? You still remember which songs?
Oh, there's pretty much in different versions of what we saw in the end. The big moment for me was listening to Light My Candle, because I think in my experience, and I would maybe point to somebody like Puccini as the best example of this, Puccini was as much a dramatist as he was a composer. He had an innate sense of drama. And he constructed human life with music. And what I was experiencing was that there were plenty of people who knew how to write a tune, and there were plenty of people who knew how to tell a story, but the people in the middle who could tell a story with music or through music were very, it's a very special group. And I felt and light my candle. Oh, this is a guy who can write a good pop song and he can tell a story. There's two characters who meet and they're different at the end in this one song. This is unusual.
And it's also very funny at the same
time. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Wonderful sense of humor.
Yeah.
Very truthful. That's what ignited this thing in my gut about pursuing this with him, because I thought he had it. What he wasn't at the time was a good playwright. He was a great songwriter, great theatrical songwriter. So the process of that 4 years was really about how do we help you become the playwright that's going to support the brilliant songwriter that you are?
So how many workshops did you do of that?
Oh, many. Many. Yeah, I mean, the biggest one was a year before we committed to doing it, because he'd won a big award and it came with some money to a theater to produce a workshop version. Mm-hmm. So we did a 2-week run, produced, rehearsed. And that did with my saying to him, okay, we will produce this play, this thing, but you're not the playwright that you need. You, the composer, lyricist, need a better playwright, a more confident, skilled, virtuosic playwright. Mm-hmm. So either we will bring somebody in to write that script with you, or you will have to, we're going to make you work with a dramaturg who will help you forge and grow and learn. And that's the avenue he chose. And it worked.
Who did it?
A woman named Lynn Thompson.
Yes.
Who then sued, and it was a big nasty mess, but.
About like what she contributed.
Yes.
To that's a whole other story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lawsuits on Broadway.
Yes. Yes.
Not Broadway, but a theater.
Yeah.
So interesting. So it went also through different workshop stages before you even decided to then do it.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we were not in any position to find out, because it would kill us.
Financially.
It was massive for us. And so every step of the way, all decisions were not mine alone. We were communally figuring out what challenge do we want institutionally. Yeah. To take on.
Why was it that big of a success?
Well, I think it spoke to a generation. For me, being in the age of our president, we were all in a different head and a sort of unfolding horror and anxiety. In Viva la Vie Boheme, the moment stops and Marx says, the opposite of war isn't peace, it's creation. And that became the center of it. And I think what I understood now at 74 years old, looking back on a 30-year-old, that goes right back to the core of who I am and what I want to see, which is we gather and that catastrophe, a war, illness, a pandemic, is the excuse that brings us together, because we're too fucked up as a species to do that with in a natural or positive way. We have to have wounds and bloodshed in order to bond. And out of that bond, we create ways to get better. And that's the force of creativity, is from this wounding, that what we're experiencing is this wounding, but it's going to lead us to someplace better. And I think that's what Jonathan was about. Community building, and that unfortunately often had to be, in that case, an epidemic of death. And I think he documented that. I think that's what the piece is about, is that you are challenged in life. Challenges are put in your pathway for you to overcome and find yourself.
Rent was 19.
Right.
96.
Six.
Wanted to ask about a project you did more recently before retiring from the New York Theatre Workshop. It's Slave Play.
Oh,
I wanted
yes.
to ask about that. Not a musical, but Rent is a musical that was a play. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about that, because I didn't have the chance to see it. I read about it in Germany, also a thing that started at New York Theatre Workshop, yep. and also went on to Broadway and then yes. to run. So different kind of success.
Yes. The playwright, Jeremy O'Harris, applied for our, still have it, a fellowship for writers and directors and designers to come and be in our midst for a year to have a fall project and a spring project. It can be the same. They could be something that's underway, whatever. There was no set structure to what those projects could be. They were self-defined. And then we would respond the best we could mm-hmm. once they made a proposal. So he applied to our program and was accepted. At the same time, he had applied to the Yale School of Drama as a playwright. And he went, chose to go there. But we met him and we connected to him and we stayed in touch with him. So that's a 3-year program. Somewhere into the second year, so year and a half after we'd first met him, he started writing this play. And he was running into resistance from faculty. Someone actually told him, you can't write this play. It's not allowed. You can't write it. My approach to this, because Jeremy is gay, and that was obvious, sort of unspoken connection that we had. I saw the play as a queer play. So in other words, to me, cosplay, role-playing, submission, domination, whatever, it's Tuesday night in a gay bar, yeah. you know? Like, yeah. what's the big deal? I didn't see what a Black woman would see in watching an actress, a Black female actress playing a slave submitting to a white master. Didn't occur to me. And boom, it exploded at us doing it. And partly I felt like that's, you know, we are not a big enough organization to handle this mess, but also it's proof of the power of this play. It's touching something, forcing people's fingers onto a live wire. So let's keep going. Yeah, so that's what it was. And interestingly, it changed very delicately, subtly, surgically from when it was done at the workshop and then when it moved to Broadway. Know the play at all?
Yes, I read it.
Oh, so the third act, when the two finally are in bed together and she says to him, you know, I agreed to this therapy because I know it was going to be hard for me to play a slave. Do you understand that? How hard and difficult and painful that was for me to do that? But I did it because I believe in this marriage. And I wanted to do what I could do to save this marriage. And in the moment where you had that same choice, you backed away. He consents to do it finally, and he persuades it. And then the end, the play, which also got a lot of feedback, was her saying to him, thank you. What happened on the transfer downtown, it was her room, that last act, that he came into. When it went uptown, it was his room she came into. No one noticed it. But unconsciously, it was not him invading her space. It was her choosing to go into his space. It made a huge difference.
I forgot. Is it in a hotel
yeah.
room?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other little change they made is at the very end, the last words in the downtown version, she said, thank you, him. Uptown, she said, thank you. Thank you for listening. Were tiny little changes that no one really noticed, but made the experience different.
How many workshops did this play have?
It didn't have much.
Okay.
Partly what happened is, you know, we... In the midst of the pandemic, we had the George Floyd moment here. but we were also under, like every not-for-profit entity in this country. For 3 or 4 years before that, we had all been going through diversity, equity, inclusion trainings and all of that. And they were very useful, helpful. I learned a lot, whatever. But then we did a reading of this play when he was about to graduate. Was the play that was coming to us because no one would do it. He couldn't write it at Yale. He had to write it on his own. And then he produced it on his own, not through officially through the school. And we did this reading. And I remember sitting in that reading thinking, this is astonishing to me. And I think I'm learning more about all of this history of our culture watching this play than all of those nice, acceptable academic training programs. Learning more watching this. We got to do it. So it was very quick. That reading was in the spring and we produced it in the winter.